Today is March 15th, and I am back with Carlos Moraes for the third day of the Pew interview. So, I wanted to, again, I always have a few follow-up questions. So, this time, you know, yesterday, actually both days, we talked a little bit about how you came to shift gears and go to Colombia. And I was wondering, though, what was going through your mind? I mean, did you have any interest in changing directions or in this project? Or, I mean, what was going on inside of you that made you do that?
It was a lot of chance, I think. Mm-hmm. I was definitely getting to the end of my rope in the place I was. So, mm-hmm. you know, I was there for many years, I think 4 years. Mm-hmm. And I wanted a change. But this change really could have taken any direction. And I think the fact that I went to New York was pure chance. A little before that, I don't remember exactly when, but I also interviewed for a job in a chemical company in São Paulo that I would be doing, I don't know, quality control or something like that. Mm-hmm. So they had a test to get in. It was actually Dow Chemicals, multinational. And I applied there because during my trip in the United States after college, I met a guy that worked at Dow. Mm. And, you know, I wrote to him asking him about you know, some job possibilities, either in the States or in São Paulo. And he gave me, you know, the number there at the Dow Chemical in São Paulo. And I contacted and I went to do a test. But I was probably ill-prepared for a chemical test, and I didn't do very well. But if I had done well, and maybe if there was a position, I don't know, you know, my life would be completely different. Mm-hmm. So I think there's a lot of chance involved. I don't think I planned my career early on and worked towards it. I had this trend and this tendency to, you know, try to look for something better, and I was always very curious and very industrious, I think. So maybe that eventually would lead me to a research career, but I don't know. Mm-hmm. Maybe not. So, you know, if I had not stopped the work in the lab I was, I probably would have done a PhD there. That's what most people do. They do the master's and then mm-hmm. a PhD. And then they go for a postdoc in usually in a lab in the United States or Europe that's related to the work you did in your PhD.
Right.
And then people go back and maybe be hired as a faculty in that same group that, you know, just inflates. So there's not much stimulation for people to diversify. Mm-hmm. And, you know, maybe I saw early on that I didn't want to just be one more in that group that already had too many chiefs and not enough Indians. So maybe I'll be out of it in one way or another. But the way I got out was very circumstantial.
Mm-hmm. Was going to the States part of it, or...?
Well, finding that friend that mm-hmm. put me in contact with mm-hmm. Billy Di Mauro,
yeah.
and you know, getting a fellow PhD fellowship yeah. and all that. If it was not for that encounter, I would not have done that, mm-hmm. and my career would, you know, have taken a completely different path.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, let's talk about the work, and you know how you kind of evolved from that into what you're doing now.
Well, so when I got to New York, I was in this big group that was specialized in studying metabolic myopathies, mainly muscle diseases, but also some nerve and muscle diseases. And at that time, they were kind of focused on mitochondrial abnormalities. mitochondria is this organelle inside the cell where energy is produced. And if you have a problem with the function of mitochondria, usually you don't have enough energy, and you know, tissues like brain and muscle that require a lot of energy will suffer first. But you can have other tissues involved. So at that time, in 87, these disorders were diagnosed mainly because of pathological features. So you'll take a muscle biopsy, for example, and see the mitochondria was abnormal. There was a little bit of biochemistry showing that some enzymes could be decreased, but that was very inconsistent. So I think I mentioned that just briefly, but in 88, there were two papers, one in Nature and one in Science, describing for the first time mutations in the mitochondrial DNA. And we had, and we even joked about it, all those patients in the freezer, that were actually pieces of tissues from patients, but they were relatively easy to go back and study retrospectively. So it was a very productive time, because we had a lot of work to do, and almost anything we'd do would be very interesting and new. So I was lucky enough also to have a postdoctoral fellow called Massimo Zeviani, that now is a major force in the field, and he's in Milan, in Italy. He was kind of finishing his training there, but he got me like a pupil or someone under his wing, and he taught me, basic molecular biology. That was the basis of everything I did since that point. So we had an overlap of a few months there, Massimo and myself. And when he left, I was kind of in charge of the molecular biology of all these diseases. That was really a very lucky position to be in that lab.
Yeah, you were a brand new graduate student.
Right, I was still in PhD, doing my PhD. But I was kind of the expert in there. Eric Schoen was the molecular biology the expert in the techniques in general, but not so much in studying patients the way we were doing, using small muscle biopsies. And of course, he could direct anyone doing that, but I was already doing. I started with Massimo, so I was on a roll.
You were doing the muscle biopsies on the patients?
No. Analyzing the DNA defects in the muscle biopsies.
Yeah.
So I was really on a roll and getting lots of data. And then, I developed some new techniques to study these muscles. For example, if you cut muscle section, in a transversal section, and you look under the microscope, you see these big fibers. Those are cells, muscle cells. And in mitochondrial diseases, it's interesting because some cells are affected and others are not. There's a mosaic. So we developed some techniques that I started that was could dissect those single fibers just using a thin pipette, and then try to analyze the DNA in those isolated fibers. And that was very nice because it gave a correlation of the presence of a DNA defect with some abnormality that muscle fiber had. So we could dissect abnormal or normal and see how the DNA was in those different ones. And we could do that for a different number of mutations that were every month there was a new mutation reported either in our lab or somewhere else. So it was a lot of good work that we could do, and it was relatively easy because everything was new. So by the time I left, well, a little bit before I left, I was a little bit bored with the studying patients and describing new mutations. I want to do something more mechanistic. So I started to get more involved with Eric Schoen, that was actually my official mentor. And I started doing riskier projects that usually would not work, but in any case, I would learn much more from them. So I did some projects that were, tried to express some gene in a cell, something that was a little bit more mechanistic, with Eric Schoen. I did some more molecular analysis with Eduardo Bonilla, also using antibodies and trying to define better how a mutation would cause a certain problem. So that gave me a broader background,
right,
in molecular biology, biochemistry, immunochemistry, etc. So by 92, 93, I was finishing my PhD, and then I had to make a decision. I don't even remember if I already talked about this. It's repeated, the editor cut it. And so I was thinking about going for a postdoctoral fellowship, and I mentioned that, but then I also mentioned how I received from Michael King this letter from Dr. Bradley, that's the chairman of neurology here. And so I decided to check it out. I talked to him, as I mentioned before, and I came for an interview that went well. I came for a second interview with Julia, also went well, and I was hired. So my work here, from the beginning, I used what I had from New York. So I had some mutations that I had described, and there were these new techniques that actually Michael King applied in New York, and I learned it was to use these cells without mitochondrial DNA to repopulate them with the exogenous mitochondrial DNA. And that was very useful to study patient-related mutations, because we could put those mutations in cells that grow very well in culture. Mm-hmm. And so I started doing that, and I applied for an NIH grant on that, and it was funded because, again, things were very novel at that point. And I think in the first, 3 to 4 years, that was the basis of my work, mainly studying mitochondrial DNA mutations in these cells that were repopulated with patients' mitochondrial DNA. I was also studying patients' tissues and still describing some new mutations or new variations. I continue to collaborate with Colombia, particularly with Giovanni Manfredi. That's a very good friend of mine these days, and we still collaborate. And he was with the Colombia group until recently. Now he has his own lab at Cornell Medical Center. So, mainly patient-related mutations. I also start to do some projects that involved potential ways to ameliorate the defect caused by these mitochondrial DNA mutations. And those were very difficult projects that I'm still working on, and they're very hard to work and to give the desired final result, but I'm insisting. For example, expressing genes that are usually in the mitochondrial DNA in the nucleus. This is a valid approach because we cannot insert genes into the mitochondrial DNA. There are no techniques available for that. But we can insert genes in the nucleus. So if we take a mitochondrial gene, but then we have to recode the whole gene because the genetic code is different. And we have to modify, they have to make a number of things, and then express in the nucleus. I've been trying to do that. Other people in the field have been trying to do that with different genes, and it seems to be a very difficult problem. I don't know how specific you want to get into the different projects.
Well, this will most likely be read by non-scientists, so an overview is good. But I just had a question about what you were saying. If you modify the gene in order to put it in the nucleus instead of mitochondria, how do you know that it has the same function?
You modify it in a way that still codes for the same protein. Mm-hmm. But it's just that the codon that's read, let's say, like a methionine in the mitochondria, is different from what's read as a methionine in the ribosomes in the cytosol. So if you want to be a methionine, you have to change the gene for the final product to be the same.
Okay.
So other projects involved, again, these mutations in the tRNA genes that are the transport RNAs. Those are small RNA molecules that are necessary for protein synthesis. there are some mutations there that cause human disease. And one of the problems with one of these mutations seems to be that the amino acid that has to attach to the DNA, it doesn't attach very well. Mm-hmm. So I also started to develop some projects to find this enzyme that attaches the amino acid to the DNA and try to overexpress it and try to maybe improve protein synthesis in these defective cells. Mm-hmm. So I've been doing this kind of projects, but also a few years ago started to do something that had more of an evolutionary spin, that was to try to put in a human cell mitochondrial DNA from different species. And I tried putting from quite divergent species like rodents, things like that, and as was expected from some earlier work, the mitochondrial DNA from these species could not coexist with the nuclear DNA from a human cell. It's just that there are too many interactions between these two DNAs, and they were too different in a way. So finally we did systematically with different primates mitochondrial DNA, and we found that chimpanzee mitochondrial DNA and gorilla mitochondrial DNA could coexist and be functional with the human nucleus. But if you use mitochondrial DNA from primates that have diverged from humans longer, like orangutan or old world monkeys or new world monkeys, those could not function well with the human nucleus. So that was quite interesting because it gives us perspective of the coevolution of nucleus and mitochondria, how all these interactions, you know, have coevolved to produce energy. And there were lots of spin-offs from this work. For example, even these cells that we could, that the mitochondrial DNA from chimpanzee, for example, could coexist with the human nucleus, they were still a little bit defective. And we characterized these defects in a little bit more details. And those defects were quite specific, so they could mimic some defects that are observed in some neuromuscular disease, neurodegenerative disorders. So we published a series of papers using these cells as models for defects in mitochondria. More recently, we start to work also with some cancer cells that were described as having mutations in the mitochondrial DNA. We actually don't have anything published on that yet, but we have a graduate student working on it for a couple of years now. So the group of Bert Wolgenstein, that's a famous group at Hopkins working on cancer, described these mutations in colorectal tumors, mutations in the mitochondrial DNA. Those were somatic mutations, meaning that they were not present in the neighbor healthy tissue, only in the tumor. But they had no clue if these mutations had any functional significance. And that's where our expertise could help. So we got these cells from his lab and Jim Wilson's lab. And we have been trying to characterize how mutations in the mitochondrial DNA affect function or not. And this is quite interesting. We have also started to work with apoptosis or cell death. That's a very in vogue topic these days. Right. And again, mitochondria is crucial in cell death. And we're trying to use our expertise in biochemistry, mitochondrial genetics, use the models we have to try to address some problems that maybe other people cannot or would not. So these are the main projects that are going on right now in the lab. I still do work with mutations in mitochondrial DNA found in patients, still trying to characterize those. Also, branching a little bit more in some neurodegenerative disorders like amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, and we have a grant from the Muscular Dystrophy Association to do this work. We're trying to identify or characterize the mitochondrial involvement in some mouse models of ALS. Mm-hmm. that mitochondria seems to be affected early on. So we're trying to see how relevant that is to the development of the disease. Also, we're trying to create some models of other neurodegenerative diseases by knocking out some mitochondrial oxidative phosphorylation genes, that does this ATP-producing genes. And this might mimic Parkinson's disease or Alzheimer's disease also. That's
or what? Parkinson's or what?
Alzheimer's. So, yeah, we are quite diversified. Still limited in number of people working and, you know, their commitment.
That's a lot of different projects for a small lab.
Yeah, I mean, that's also related to how I run the lab, I think. I try not to overlap too much project between two different people. I like people to feel that they have their own project. And of course, you can have several sub-projects in a big one. But then you have more chance of overlaps and political problems and things like that. Sometimes the spread can be a problem. But hopefully I'll be able to know when I'm spreading too thin.
You know, because you sort of stumbled into this, it brings up something that interests me, which is, you know, was it just a lucky chance that you fell into something you liked? Or did you like it because you started working in it and it became interesting to you?
The latter one. I think I could be working in anything related to life science and I'll be happy about it. I find everything interesting. I don't think, you know, even to have a clinical relevance is not a major thing for me. I could as well be working something extremely basic with no direct relevance to clinical research. And be just as happy. So, yeah, I think I like it because I started working on it. But again, being honest, I think if I was in a different field, I would like it just as much. If you know, if something that you see that you're making a contribution and you understand it well, I get very interested. I become interested, and I like it.
Okay.
Yeah, I hear some people talking about that. You know, I always wanted to do diabetes research or this kind of research. That's definitely not my case. I like life science. I always liked life science. But there, and even could be archaeology or something like that. That's not really life science. I'll still be enjoying it, I think. Yeah, what I really like about the research is the lack of a routine. And yeah, it's extremely challenging because you know you can set up your own goals, and those can be hard to achieve. So you can make it as challenging as you want.
So if you had to say what the thing that you like the most is, would it be the lack of routine or something else? If you had to say,
yeah, I think the lack of routine is close to the top. The excitement and frustrations of research, I think, are also very something I like. I mean, the lows, of course, I don't like the lows, but they make the highs nicer when they come.
Yeah.
And also the unpredictability of the results, and that motivates me, and you know, I enjoy that kind of stuff. Particularly when I was working more in the lab, you know, when you are developing an X-ray, and in those few seconds you start to see a band come up, and you know, you have some expectations, and the result might not fill those expectations. You know, it makes your adrenaline pump, at least. Makes my adrenaline pump.
It's like a good wave.
So when they come and when the result is good, you know, you have a lot of pleasure out of it. I like to finish some, you know, body of work. I have a lot of satisfaction getting a paper finished and published. But yeah, I also, and I think that's a plus, I'm not someone that likes to commemorate or enjoy too much something that I accomplished. You know, mm-hmm. Once I enjoy to accomplish and leave it behind, that's how I see these things. You know, mm-hmm. Once I finish something, that's it. Mm-hmm. Let's go to the next one. And in research, you can do that. Because, you know, you finish certain pieces of work, and of course you continue the same line, but mm-hmm. you have accomplished something very concrete. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting also how a finished piece of work looks nice and organized, and when you look the way that you came to that point was, you know, mm-hmm. not that organized, and even the way you tell the story was not in the same time frame or the same sequence mm-hmm. that it actually happened. And, you know, if you see my office, it's a huge mess. But when I mail something out, it's very organized. So I find that interesting also, that you can be juggling with a number of things and still you make something very neat mm-hmm. at the end. Mm-hmm. Like this morning, for example, that I had to cancel our 9:30 thing. I had to get some preliminary results for a grant that a colleague of mine is putting to buy a confocal microscope. So mm-hmm. it will be a shared equipment grant. Mm-hmm. And I told them that those guys were demonstrating the equipment and they're trying to install yesterday. So I had only this morning to do it. Uh-huh. So I just got some cells. I ran there. We tried to, you know, do whatever we could, and the machine is very nice, so the guy actually could get some neat images. So after this interview, I'll probably go back there, get those images, try to pack it together in the few pages that would be my part in a grant, and send it out, hopefully get funded. But, you know, it's a very chaotic process, but somehow you can make a nice final product, even something small like that. Yeah. So I enjoy that mm-hmm. aspect of the work.
Mm-hmm. What do you like the least?
What I like the least is the administrative burden. Uh-huh. I already mentioned I don't like to teach, and mm-hmm. I don't teach much, mm-hmm. so I'm happy with that. I like to have contact with students, but closer contact, more at the mentoring level than lecturing. You know, but then you have committee meetings that also someone has to do it, I understand, and I do it, but I don't like doing it. We were talking earlier about not having a secretary. My office is a complete mess. I wish I was more organized, but also I feel that I really don't have time to organize. The way I do it, it's every 3 to 4 months, my office becomes so bad that I have to stop everything, and organize, clean everything, and then it's very neat. Mm-hmm. And a week later, I'm already
starting
going through hell again.
Yeah,
that's how it works. So, you know, every day I get a number of faxes about things I have to fix, machines I have to fix, grants I have to review, papers I have to review. So I don't particularly like that. It's not that I don't dislike that, but that takes all of my time. And I truly dislike the fact that I'm becoming more and more distant from the lab. Mm-hmm. I don't like that. The politics of science, I actually enjoy. I find, mm-hmm. you know, competition and collaboration something healthy and normal in life. Mm-hmm. So, of course, you have people that you like more and like less in the field. You can be more secretive or less secretive. But I think that's all fair game. And really, that I don't have a problem with that. Mm-hmm. I try to be very friendly with everybody in the field and very generous. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I expect people to do the same. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so I have a good time in my field. I think people like me. They probably respect me at the level that I should be respected at this point in my career. So I like the politics of science. And, you know, once in a while you have a character that's a little weird, and will behave in, you know, some strange way, either because the person's too competitive, too egocentric, or it's not low self-esteem, but too afraid to be scooped or something like that. And they'll behave in a not very collegial way. But that's okay. It happens in every profession.
Mm-hmm. Well, a couple of those subjects are on my list of things to talk about. So let's explore this business for a few minutes of competition. Because you had said the other day that was why the American system works well, because of competition. What is the upside of competition and the downside of competition?
Well, the upside is that you can't take too long to get something done, mm-hmm. because otherwise you're going to read about it. Mm-hmm. So that makes things move much faster. And again, I can make a parallel with Brazil, with my experience with Brazil, where the pressure is not as high. It's not as high to publish, not even as high to get funds, because you know, you might not have many research funds, but your salary is guaranteed from the time you get a job. Mm-hmm. And things move much slower, much slower. Here in the United States, if you are too slow, you're not going to get funded. They're not going to publish good papers, and they're going to perish. So that's the upside, I think. Makes things move faster, so productivity is high. Downside, it's very stressful and makes you work very hard. But, you know, that's the price you pay for being very productive. And
Have you ever been scooped on anything?
Oh, yeah. More than once. And, usually I know that I'm going to be scooped, because mm-hmm. I know that the person that's working on the project is slow. And you know that a competitor is working hard on it, or has a lab that's more powerful and can put more resources there. So, yeah, I have been, but I do not get, of course, I get a bit depressed, but not very depressed, because I think that's part of the game, and I should be expecting that this will happen. And hopefully I'll scoop some people also. So, you know, it's a give and take.
Well, one of the fears I think that people have when they're starting out is that, you know, they're going to have all their eggs in one project, one basket.
Well, I don't have that.
No, you don't. But your fellows do.
Yes.
You know, and if they get scooped, they can tank their whole career.
Well, I like fellows to have at least three projects. And those are usually three, they can be completely different projects. Two reasons. One, because in research, I think one project is people have much more time in their hands than what they need for one project. Lots of experiments take time. Some experiments take days, you know, when you're selecting cells or things like that. So people definitely have time to run at least three projects. And of course, also, some will not work. Mm-hmm. Hopefully some will. So, yeah, I definitely try to protect them in this way. And also, if I see that they are in all very difficult projects, I try to give them an extra one that's more like a certain thing. Mm-hmm. I think it's very sad if people stay in the lab for a number of years and cannot publish anything. Mm-hmm. It has happened in my lab, as we discussed with that American fellow. But I did try. I gave him one, you know, more like bread and butter kind of project. That he advanced to a point, but, you know, cells got contaminated and this and that, so he couldn't finish that also. Mm. So, someone else is going to pick it up and finish that.
What happened to him, though?
He became a senior technician.
Oh, okay. So he didn't graduate.
Well, he was a PhD from UCSD.
Oh, okay.
So he was doing a postdoc.
Yeah.
But, he was not very hungry.
Yeah. Okay. So now what about collaboration, though? How important is that in your work?
Yeah, it's... I think that the best thing about collaboration is that it's fun. Mm-hmm. Not only that, but then you're discussing science with a peer, and you can actually learn things. This is particularly important for someone like me, that I'm here relatively isolated in this island of Florida. There are not, too many groups, particularly in my field. There are some people in Gainesville or in other universities, but here in the area, not much. Even though everybody at the university that works on mitochondria, I'm in close contact and I'm collaborating. And the example I just gave you about the shared equipment is part of that. Mm-hmm. I actually have started, and I'm proud of this, a mitochondrial club here at the university. So we have like 6 different PIs and people from these groups that meet once a month. And I got some money from the Dean for Research to buy food. So we have, a meeting with food and a very lively discussion. Mm-hmm. So it's different from a regular seminar because we just interrupt the person that's presenting all the time. And we discuss mainly projects in progress. Mm-hmm. So people get a lot of suggestions. Mm-hmm. So I think these things are very important. Mainly because of this, you're talking to people that can teach you something.
Mm-hmm. It's okay. Is there any downside to competition? I mean,
to collaboration? Yeah.
Aside from writing book chapters.
Right. It distracts you. It sometimes takes, makes you less focused. Mm-hmm. I know people that are, the only thing they do is to run around with, trying to do collaborations and they don't have their own thing.
Yeah.
So, particularly if you have some funds and you are relatively successful, people would want to collaborate with you even if it's to have your name on a grant. Mm-hmm. And that's usually okay because you don't have to do much. Mm-hmm. But collaborations in excess can be a nuisance for sure, and can distract you from your main goals. Mm-hmm. So definitely there is a downside to it. Particularly if you're doing more for political purposes, not so much because you're interested in that project. Mm-hmm. But, for example, as a follow-up on that project that we're mixing nucleus from one species and mitochondrial DNA from another species, I start collaborating with a biotech company, Advanced Cell Technologies, that are doing cloning of animals, and they're trying to do interspecies cloning. So that's a fantastic collaboration because we can see, when you do a interspecific cloning, you use the egg from one species and the nuclear donor from a different species. Now, the mitochondrial DNA is going to be in the egg, so you're going to have some kind of potentially incompatibility there. Mm-hmm. And, they are trying to clone an endangered species of cow called Bos gaurus that's from the Southeast Asia, mm-hmm. using the oocyte from a normal cow, Bos taurus. And we published a paper together with them showing that, these clones, at least these fetuses that they could obtain, had the nucleus from one species and the mitochondrial DNA from a different one. Mm-hmm. Potentially that can be a problem if you try to use this technique to rescue endangered species. Mm-hmm. So those kinds of collaborations are great because that's not something we can do, but we can use our expertise to their benefit also to characterize a very specific part of the project. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So overall, collaborations are great if you're interested in them and you're not just doing it because, the chairman wants you to do it or something like that.
Yeah. Okay. Let's pause for a second.